Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Shalom leYehudim, shalom leBnei Noach, shalom leGoyim. This is Shai Bet Tekoa, webcasting to you from the hills of Judea, a.k.a. occupied Palestine, a country so alien to the Arabs they cannot properly pronounce its name. This is Phantom Nation, an internet radio podcast named for the book of the same name available on Amazon that exposes the fraud of an allegedly ancient, putatively prehistoric Palestinian Bible with the identical right the Jews have to an independent state in their historic homeland, as the League of Nations described Palestine in 1922. And never mind, the League never said one word at that time or ever over 25 years of its lifespan about any Palestinians. Although Israel's immediate enemies are the Arabs and Muslims occupying our country, it's tragic that in post-Jewish Israel's drive to be accepted as a normal nation in friendly relations with its non-Jewish neighbors, it damages its ability to think clearly about our mortal enemies. Israel's leaders are mostly post-religious Ashkenazim, and as such are blocked from seeing our neighbors, these Hamitic Ishmaelites, as they really are. As my book highlights, the Palestinian national identity was as much an invention of the Israeli Ashkenazi left, desperate to clash with a parallel nationalist community and not a religious one. The Oslo peace cultists like Yossi Beilin and Tzipora Livni are on record saying if the conflict is defined as religious, then there's no hope for peace. So let's define it as a nationalist conflict, Israelis versus Palestinians. In that framework, a mutually respectful compromise becomes possible. Trouble is, the Arabs don't know what you're talking about. The Arabs remain essentially subnational, tribal. For them, their largest group identity is Islam. Yemen has never been a unified Arab state. Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, created after World War I, are failed states. Libya, they're all creations of Western nations. All of them failed. Israelis are also trying to pressure, cajole, tempt, persuade the Arabs here to make peace and respect our right to our independent state. Only they are incapable of that because they are overwhelmingly Muslims whose religion mandates oppressing and humiliating Jews. The demand that they respect our right to an independent state is breathtakingly ignorant of what this violence is all about. And we'll get started after the following message or two from Israel News Talk Radio.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Shalom leYehudim, shalom leBnei Noach, shalom leGoyim. This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, webcasting to you from the hills of Judea, a.k.a. the occupied Palestinian territories, birthplace of the Jewish people. This is Phantom Nation, an internet radio podcast named for the book of the same name, available on Amazon. The so-called Palestinians are this Phantom Nation, allegedly ancient, putatively prehistoric, and this book records the invention of this lie, this fake history of another people besides the Jews with the identical right to an independent state in the identical promised land of the Jewish people's Torah. It is the second day. Parshas Va'era, Tashin, Ayin Ches, 5778. The first day, Monday, 8 January 2018, webcasting from the modern state of Israel, some of whose leading Israelis still don't get it. And who are these leading Israelis who still don't get it? By and large, Ashkenazic post-religionists, product of the anti-religious, a.k.a. secular Zionists, who dedicate a national day every year to Theodor Herzl. Jose HaMedina, he's called the visionary of the state. They chose not to call him the prophet who foresaw the state, for that is a religious concept, and that's not for them. Jewishness holds high the banner of free will, and of course they have the right to think the way they do. But a worldview like this has consequences. Being anti-religious in arguably the most religious region in the world, surrounded on three sides by over half a billion, mostly Muslims, whose religion is all they have, and it is a form of anti-Semitism, being dismissive of religion as Israel's ruling elite is, that makes them ill-equipped when it comes to seeing the enemy as clearly as one might. Combine this with the post-religious hunger for a place among the nations, which was the title of the book written by Benjamin Netanyahu in the 1980s, and you get an Israeli ruling elite that doesn't get it. For example, it's welcome news that President Trump does not want the U.S. to give money anymore to people who don't want to make peace with Israel, namely the PA, Palestinian Authority, so-called, and UNRWA, the UN refugee agency, just for them, which in reality is the greatest scam in UN history, bigger than the oil-for-food scam of the 1990s. The biggest scam, though, is the UN itself. Unlike every other effort in history known to man, made by people trying to help war refugees who flee from their country during war to reestablish themselves in a new life in another country, UNRWA has never done that. UNRWA is the greatest welfare scam in history. 70% of the people in Gaza live on this dole. Free schools, free medical care, and no employment. And this goes for the other dozens of such UNRWA operations in other Arab countries. And the reason for this began with the refusal of the Arab states to take care of the Arab refugees who came out of their failed war of aggression against Israel in 1948-49. One reason for the refusal, understandable, these refugees were overwhelmingly not native to Palestine, but a mixed bag of migrant workers from all over the Middle East who had gone to mandatory Palestine between the two major wars looking for work. They were commonly unskilled illiterates, the poorest of the poor. They ran from the fighting in 1948 because they had no property to hold on to or fight for, protect. The two ports of Haifa and Jaffa were surrounded by shanty towns in those years by these migrants who worked as manual laborers in the ports and at other jobs. And when the Arab armies invaded in 1948, these migrants understandably ran from the fighting, expecting the Arab armies to kill all the Jews real fast, and then they could return to loot the property of the now dead Jews, God forbid. Only things didn't work out that way, did they? And the Arab states who invaded did not look upon these poorest of the poor, trapped behind enemy lines now, from our point of view, as members of their communities in Egypt, Syria, Iraq. I've spent time with the Arab upper crust, and they look upon such migrant laborers as okies, as dust, as barely more than animals. The Arab states also, in their classic timeless inability to confront their own guilt, insisted that there would have been no refugees at all if the UN had not given the Jews permission to have an independent state. In their eyes, the UN is thus responsible, and for decades the Arab states have refused to pay for the maintenance of these refugees. A tertiary benefit for the existence of UNRWA for 70 years has been using them as living examples of the crimes of the perfidious Jews who stole Palestine from the Palestinians and forced these people to live in these slums. Where would journalists like LTF, Little Tommy Friedman, the columnist in the New York Times, be without these slum areas to point to and accuse the Jews in Israel for their plight? In the early 1970s, Arik Sharon had the idea of bulldozing the eight UNRWA areas in Gaza and building in their place modest cottages and offering low-interest mortgage rates to the Arab refugees, identical to those offered to new Jewish immigrants. But when that plan was made public, the Arabs and Soviet bloc went screaming to the UN, "Don't you dare try to improve their living conditions." Some of them at the time even admitted that this would reduce their hatred for Israel. They also rejected the idea of building permanent cottages and communities for them in Gaza because they have the right to return to their ancestral sods stolen by the Jews. This reminds yours truly of a column in the New York Times cited in my book by foreign affairs opinionator C.L. Sulzberger, describing Cairo's famous City of the Dead Cemetery where the poorest of the poor make their homes as squatters in the tombs. He also saw the occasional little beggar boy missing a hand because his family, so poor with so many kids, decided that this boy would be taken to a local amateur surgeon who chopped off his hand in order to make him a more pitiable beggar. This is with whom we're dealing, these Arabs, these Muslims, whose culture is so different from ours. Too many Israelis, though, cannot appreciate the abyss of culture that separates us from them and makes the idea of peace at this time unrealistic. And worse, Israelis think it's possible to reform the Arabs and get them to make peace, get them to change and become friendlier to us. My candidate for the most glaring example of this horrible attitude is the and the iconic image, really, of the entirety of the Oslo fiasco abomination, was a photograph in 1998 of Shimon Peres kissing Yasser Arafat on the cheek in Arafat's fifth year of refusing to rewrite the PLO covenant, calling for Israel's destruction, which was the core demand of the Israelis in exchange for the so-called peace process. That brought no peace, but a tsunami of innocent Jewish blood spilled during the Second Intifada. This attitude of trying to get the Arabs to make peace with us was also on display in a moment at Camp David in July 2000 at the doorway to a cabin where President Bill Clinton, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and that reptile Arafat were about to enter to negotiate peace. I forget the initial steps of the encounter, but it was something like, you know, who goes first, smiles on all three faces, which concluded with Ehud Barak, in a kind of fraternity house bear hug, pulled an ever-grinning Arafat inside. This was shortly before Arafat told Clinton and Ehud Barak that the Jews never had any temples on the Temple Mount. And Barak and Clinton understood Oslo was over, because it never began. And Arafat is a lunatic. Ehud Barak's body language at that moment with Arafat was friendly, clearly in the belief that by being nice to this toxic gargoyle of a man, he could be cajoled into making peace. This was, mind you, 7 years after the delirious handshake on the White House lawn. Hope springs eternal for Israelis like these who someday see the Ishmaelites here behaving differently, and never mind that their behavior today is unchanged from what it was thousands of years ago. Read the few verses in the Torah concerning the man Ishmael. Read the brilliant commentaries by our most brilliant rabbis about these verses, and you will see the Arabs today, the Muslims, are unchanged, and therefore immune to Israelis who think they can change them.
Thank you. Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling from the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Shalom leYehudim, shalom leBnei Noach, shalom leGoyim. This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, webcasting to you from the hills of Judea, a.k.a. the occupied Palestinian territories, birthplace of the Jewish people. This is Phantom Nation, an internet radio podcast named for the book of the same name, available on Amazon. The so-called Palestinians are this phantom nation, allegedly ancient, putatively prehistoric, and this book records the invention of this lie, this fake history of another people besides the Jews with the identical right to an independent state in the identical promised land of the Jewish people's Torah. It is the second day. Parshas Va'era, Tashin, Ayin Ches, 5778. The first day, Monday, 8 January 2018, webcasting from the modern state of Israel, some of whose leading Israelis still don't get it. And who are these leading Israelis who still don't get it? By and large, Ashkenazic post-religionists, product of the anti-religious, a.k.a. secular Zionists, who dedicate a national day every year to Theodor Herzl. José Hamedina, he's called the visionary of the state. They chose not to call him the prophet who foresaw the state, for that is a religious concept, and that's not for them. Jewishness holds high the banner of free will, and of course they have the right to think the way they do. But a worldview like this has consequences. Being anti-religious in arguably the most religious region in the world, surrounded on three sides by over half a billion, mostly Muslims, whose religion is all they have, and it is a form of anti-Semitism, being dismissive of religion as Israel's ruling elite is, that makes them ill-equipped when it comes to seeing the enemy as clearly as one might. Combine this with the post-religious hunger for a place among the nations, which was the title of the book written by Benjamin Netanyahu in the 1980s, and you get an Israeli ruling elite that doesn't get it. For example, it's welcome news that President Trump does not want the U.S. to give money anymore to people who don't want to make peace with Israel. Namely the PA, Palestinian Authority, so-called, and UNRWA, the UN refugee agency, just for them, which in reality is the greatest scam in UN history, bigger than the oil-for-food scam of the 1990s. The biggest scam, though, is the UN itself. Unlike every other effort in history, known to man, made by people trying to help war refugees who flee from their country during war to reestablish themselves in a new life in another country, UNRWA has never done that. UNRWA is the greatest welfare scam in history. 70% of the people in Gaza live on this dole. Free schools, free medical care, and no employment. And this goes for the other dozens of such UNRWA operations in other Arab countries. And the reason for this began with the refusal of the Arab states to take care of the Arab refugees who came out of their failed war of aggression against Israel in 1948-49. One reason for the refusal is understandable. These refugees were overwhelmingly not native to Palestine, but a mixed bag of migrant workers from all over the Middle East who had gone to mandatory Palestine between the two major wars looking for work. They were commonly unskilled illiterates, the poorest of the poor. They ran from the fighting in 1948 because they had no property to hold on to or fight for, protect. The two ports of Haifa and Jaffa were surrounded by shanty towns in those years by these migrants who worked as manual laborers in the ports and at other jobs. And when the Arab armies invaded in 1948, these migrants understandably ran from the fighting, expecting the Arab armies to kill all the Jews real fast, and then they could return to loot the property of the now dead Jews, God forbid. Only things didn't work out that way, did they? And the Arab states who invaded did not look upon these poorest of the poor, trapped behind enemy lines now, from our point of view, as members of their communities in Egypt, Syria, Iraq. I've spent time with the Arab upper crust, and they look upon such migrant laborers as okies, as dust, as barely more than animals. The Arab states also, in their classic timeless inability to confront their own guilt, insisted that there would have been no refugees at all if the UN had not given the Jews permission to have an independent state. In their eyes, the UN is thus responsible, and for decades the Arab states have refused to pay for the maintenance of these refugees, a tertiary benefit for the existence of UNRWA for 70 years, has been using them as living examples of the crimes of the perfidious Jews who stole Palestine from the Palestinians and forced these people to live in these slums. Where would journalists like LTF, Little Tommy Friedman, the columnist in the New York Times, be without these slum areas to point to and accuse the Jews in Israel for their plight? In the early 1970s, Arik Sharon had the idea of bulldozing the 8 UNRWA areas in Gaza and building in their place modest cottages and offering low-interest mortgage rates to the Arab refugees, identical to those offered to new Jewish immigrants. But when that plan was made public, the Arabs and Soviet bloc went screaming to the UN, "Don't you dare try to improve their living conditions." Some of them at the time even admitted that this would reduce their hatred for Israel. They also rejected the idea of building permanent cottages and communities for them in Gaza because they have the right to return to their ancestral sods stolen by the Jews. This reminds yours truly of a column in the New York Times cited in my book by foreign affairs opinionator C.L. Sulzberger, describing Cairo's famous City of the Dead Cemetery, where the poorest of the poor make their homes as squatters in the tombs. He also saw the occasional little beggar boy missing a hand because his family, so poor with so many kids, decided that this boy would be taken to a local amateur surgeon who chopped off his hand in order to make him a more pitiable beggar. This is with whom we're dealing, these Arabs, these Muslims, whose culture is so different from ours. Too many Israelis, though, cannot appreciate the abyss of culture that separates us from them and makes the idea of peace at this time unrealistic. And worse, Israelis think it's possible to reform the Arabs and get them to make peace, get them to change and become friendlier to us. My candidate for the most glaring example of this horrible attitude is the iconic image, really, of the entirety of the Oslo fiasco abomination, was a photograph in 1998 of Shimon Peres kissing Yasser Arafat on the cheek in Arafat's fifth year of refusing to rewrite the PLO covenant, calling for Israel's destruction, which was the core demand of the Israelis in exchange for the so-called peace process. That brought no peace, but a tsunami of innocent Jewish blood spilled during the second Intifada. This attitude of trying to get the Arabs to make peace with us was also on display in a moment at Camp David in July 2000 at the doorway to a cabin where President Bill Clinton, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and that reptile Arafat were about to enter to negotiate peace. I forget the initial steps of the encounter, but it was something like, you know, who goes first, smiles on all three faces, which concluded with Ehud Barak in a kind of fraternity house bear hug pulled an ever-grinning Arafat inside. This was shortly before Arafat told Clinton and Ehud Barak that the Jews never had any temples on the Temple Mount. And Barak and Clinton understood Oslo was over because it never began. And Arafat is a lunatic. Ehud Barak's body language at that moment with Arafat was friendly, clearly in the belief that by being nice to this toxic gargoyle of a man, he could be cajoled into making peace. This was, mind you, 7 years after the delirious handshake on the White House lawn. Hope springs eternal for Israelis like these who someday see the Ishmaelites here behaving differently. and never mind that their behavior today is unchanged from what it was thousands of years ago. Read the few verses in the Torah concerning the man Ishmael. Read the brilliant commentaries by our most brilliant rabbis about these verses, and you will see the Arabs today, the Muslims, are unchanged, and therefore immune to Israelis who think they can change them.
Everybody, making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I'm Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
So, Israel's ruling elite of de-Judaized, that is, de-religionized, mostly Ashkenazic Jews, can write such nonsense as Lieutenant Colonel Reuven Ben Shalom did by saying the Palestinians love this land as much as we do, which is demonstrably false. Every report by a visitor, Eretz Yisrael, over the centuries said the place was a barren wasteland. And thanks to the invention of photography, a generation before the onset of the Zionist movement, there's no shortage of pictures, black and white photographs, in the National Archives of that desolation. The cover of my book is Edward Lear's 1859 painting of the walled city. From his position on Mount Scopus looking west, and you see the barren hillside that separates his place from Jerusalem, that is today called East Jerusalem. If these Palestinians love this land as much as we do, why do they neglect it and keep it as a barren wasteland? To this day, every settlement in Judea and Samaria that has been challenged in recent years by an NGO as land theft appears in today's photographs featured in the New York Times, surrounded by emptiness, barren hillsides all around. The settlements in Judea and Samaria are characteristically built on barren hilltops. No, the prehistoric Arab family was evicted from its ancestral homeland by the rebirth of a Jewish community in Judea and Samaria. Nobody lost their homes. High Court Justice Uzi Vogelman, who wrote the majority opinion on this Hamas case, quote, emphasized the extra sensitivity due to East Jerusalemites being involved versus West Bank Palestinians. Most of them, he wrote, were born, grew up, and became adults in East Jerusalem, and they lived there for decades as well as their parents and sometimes even their grandparents, close quote. For sure, he has not read my book, which uncovered the truth that there was no East Jerusalem before Jewish Israelis invented the term after the Six-Day War. The dateline in the New York Times through the Six-Day War was Jerusalem, comma, Jordanian sector. This is a good example of how enlightened post-religious Israelis have unwittingly assimilated the conventional anti-Jew narrative. This conception of generations of Palestinians living in Jerusalem is belied by the evidence. For example, in my book, one finds the article on Jerusalem in the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica containing the 1905 census, when the city was, in both times, still ruled by the Ottoman Empire. A dozen years before the Balfour Declaration, which the Arabs blame for the Zionist theft of Palestine, when London, Paris, New York already had 2 and 3 million residents apiece, Jerusalem had only 60,000 souls. 40,000 of them, Jews. 13,000 Christians, many of them Western, not Arab at all, and 7,000 Muslims, who are mostly the Turkish administration and their families, the Turkish garrison, its officers and their families. In 1905, the word Arab was synonymous with desert-dwelling, tent-dwelling nomad who did not live in cities. The 1905 census saw the people in Jerusalem as either Muslims, Christians, or Jews. No Arabs. Worst, the city was still very much a smelly Levantine medieval relic of a town into the 20th century. If Muslims loved Jerusalem as much as Jews, according to this Israeli High Court judge, why did they maintain it as a slum that yours truly personally experienced to a degree? In 1967, after the Jordanian aggressors and legal occupiers had been driven out in the war, after 2 decades of Jordanian rule in the old walled city and outside of it, it was still a slum. King Hussein invested all his money in those 2 decades in Amman. There were, I think, in old Jerusalem, I think like 3 stoplights. There were still areas with no telephone service, and open sewers. Don't tell me they love Jerusalem as much as we do. The so-called Palestinians never paved a road, never installed a sewer, never built a city park. In 1905, Jerusalem was home to 60,000, two-thirds of them Jews. Today, its population is almost 900,000, and there is only one national community responsible for this. The Jewish nation, not the phantom Palestinian nation, who claim ancestral rights in their beloved city. Here is the Israeli High Court displaying like a peacock its concern for the Arabs, the Muslims, these 4 Hamas cultists whose doctrine glorifies Jew killing. These judges apparently have no knowledge that in the creation of Pakistan, millions of Muslims and Hindus were forced to move. He has no knowledge, apparently, of the population transfer of millions in the Balkans, the Greeks and the Turks, about a century ago. No awareness that after World War II at Potsdam, Churchill and Truman ordered 10 million ethnic Germans to leave their homes in European countries outside of Germany and go live in the new truncated Germany. These ethnic Germans also had generations of history in these other countries, in Holland and Italy, Poland, but they were ordered to leave. That the Israeli High Court has trouble justifying evicting from our holy city these 4 Nazi-like Hamas thugs is depressing. I find this whole business another instance of Israelis flaunting their concern for their mortal enemy and the good opinion of Gentiles around the world, which I find pathetic, that Israel cannot bring itself to boot from Jerusalem these 4 members of Hamas. whose sulfurous covenant cites the protocols of the island of the Elders of Zion. In a class with Mein Kampf, these whose paid killers never stop trying to murder us, and sometimes do. If these were members of a local Nazi cell, wouldn't Israel find the legal power to evict them? In the High Court case, one of the justices repeatedly referenced international law as one reason not to evict them. And repeatedly she wrote, as if international law is superior to Israeli law and thousands of years of Jewish jurisprudence. Another example of what will the Gentiles say? And the pathetic need of Israelis like these to be thought well of in their eyes. Like Reuven Ben Shalom, who objected to biased narratives on both sides, citing the entitlement by God's promise on a par with Palestinian claims. Reuven Ben Shalom concluded this way, "We are rightfully appalled when Palestinian propaganda attempts to negate a Jewish connection to Jerusalem, but some of us similarly claim exclusivity instead of respecting a genuine centuries-old Muslim sentiment to the holy city. The first steps towards stability, reconciliation, and peace should be respecting history, respecting facts, and respecting each other." How unfortunate he cannot see how the second of these two sentences completely contradicts the essence of the first. First, he is appalled at lies about the history of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael, and then salutes the lies of centuries of Muslim sentiment. If Jerusalem was so important, why was it such a slum into the 20th century? Jerusalem was never an important city to the Muslims. All that is important in the city is the Jews' Temple Mount. Capturing it is what it's all about. It's a trophy of conquest. It carries no spiritual message whatsoever. It's just a trophy and proof that Islam is the final revelation of Abraham's monotheism. The same Ibrahim who in the Jews' Bible expelled his firstborn son Ishmael from his community because he knew he was such a wild ass of a man. Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Phantom Nation, available on Amazon for the next month or so at a much cheaper price than it will be in hardcover. And if you are a regular, it's the best way to express one's appreciation. Today's music was by Simply Tzfat, wonderful group in Tzfat, and by Mickey Rosenbaum, and as usual, Yosef Karduner. Until next time, I'm Shai Bentekoah. רק השם יתברך נתן לי זאת במתנה שאני יודע מהו ראש השנה והיה פלא אצלי מאחר שהמקורבים שלי מאמינים לי ולמה לא יזהר כל המקורבים אליי איש לא יעדר שיהיו על ראש השנה שיהיו כולם על ראש השנה השנה שלי הוא חידוש גדול והשם יתברך יודע שאין הדבר בירושה מאבותיי רק השם יתברך נתן לי זאת במתנה שאני יודע מהו ראש השנה והיה פלא אצלי מאחר שהמקורבים שלי מאמינים לי למה לא יזהרו כל המקורבים אליי איש לא יזהרו
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.